If you're ready to learn how technology is driving business innovation in Cincinnati and beyond, you're tuned in to the right podcast. Join us for interviews and discussions with business leaders, innovators, and visionaries. With our host, Sam Schulte, CEO of Unstoppable Software, this is Unstoppable Talk.
So we are here with Mike O'Donnell, who is the CEO of Media Systems Affiliates. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And Mike, you're based up in Milwaukee. Is that right?
Yep. Just a little west of Milwaukee, in between Milwaukee and Madison, really.
Okay.
Closer to Milwaukee, though.
And a lot of the work that you've done with MSA is work in the political space, so that's kind of going to be a bit of our conversation today. So, Mike, maybe let's talk a little bit about you and some of your background. So where are you from, and you know, where did you go to college, and how did you sort of get into the business world?
Sure. I grew up in Chicago and then to the suburbs, but the greater Chicago area, and my whole family's still there. So I have really, really close ties, but predominantly really been a Midwest guy. I ended up going to college at a small liberal arts college in Iowa. My dad actually went there, so that's not really the reason I went there, but it was a strong draw. So it was called Loras College, and they had a kind of a tri-college thing there. So it was three little schools to make up a relatively still small school. So that's kind of where I started my schooling for communication, and ended up with an advertising design degree. And I had a professor tell me that great ideas, but probably won't be a web designer or developer. So that made me angry. So I started a web design company, and more of a marketing web-based company right out of college.
Okay. And what is advertising design? So is that basically like a design degree, or I mean, is it meaning like the graphics of advertising?
That's how it started, because it was eons ago, as you know. I mean, it was still kind of desktop publishing and things like that. So what it is today is not what it was then. But I had the emphasis in the marketing and the business side of the business administration, but kind of had a little bit of a creative bone to pick with myself, so to speak. So ended up getting an advertising design, because I had just a real strong background from, you know, study wise in business. So I thought to be a little more well-rounded needed to, go towards the design. So yeah, it was more, you know, and everything from PR to, you know, layout and design, things of that nature.
So your first business was in the web design space, and when did you found that company, and what was that called?
Yeah, I had a little boutique firm called Wavelink, and just right out of college, and it was designing for print and web at that point.
Okay. And when was that?
Oh God, I think it mid to late. mid to late '90s actually.
Okay.
Because I went back to school and I was kind of doing my own little business, and then went back to school to get that advertising design degree as well. So it's kind of a hodgepodge of in and out of school and degrees and things like that. So,
sure.
And then you had the mix of meeting a girl in between there. So that affected some things as well. So who's now my wife?
Yeah. So almost like a, almost like a dorm room, almost a company you started in your dorm room type stuff. It sounds like right at the real peak or explosion of the .com boom and all that. Right.
Yeah. It was right before. And probably good, because if it was at the peak or in the middle or even the start, I probably would have been frightened out of it, you know. So
gotcha.
I think ignorance was bliss at that point.
Okay. And then you've gone on since then to found or run or be involved with a number of companies. And how did you sort of go from web design into sort of the political sphere and with some of the companies like Easy Contribution and such?
Right. Well, it was kind of, like you said, a lot of different experiences. As I was putting myself through school towards the end of getting that advertising design, I worked for a radio station, or a larger communication company that had, you know, newspapers, TV, cable, and radio. So I went anywhere from selling advertising to print to, you know, every little part of, you know, multimedia, if you want to call it that. And as I got more into all the production value and production challenges, as I noticed that from print to everywhere, they had all this extra time and their downtime, you know, so especially printers, they were going at, you know, three shifts, but if they didn't have things to print. So I kind of put together an idea to bootstrap MSA, which is Media Systems Affiliates. And I wrote a patent that was going to do digital variable media. I expanded it to, instead of just digital variable printing and digital variable web. And we go around and sign up printers and different media producers and anywhere from sales agents and things of that nature, developers, hosting companies, but mostly printers all over. And our system would take in data and make variable output onto paper. So back then it was not common, if you bought a car, to then have, you know, that mailer out to you to say, hey, Sam, you just bought a Ford, you know, here's, you got to get your new, you know, tire program, this, and it would say your name and have tires or oil change. So we kind of were a little early on that, but it was a really good experience because I was able to interact with a lot of different, like I said, media outlet type companies. And that's how I started in politics, is I had some friends who worked in politics and they said, can you print this? You know, back then people just thought, well, if you print business cards, you were a business card printer, if envelopes. And I said, hey, if it's on paper, we can do it. So we started printing and doing some get out the vote and other types of campaign, you know, literature. And so then I put our system to work for that. And then none of them had websites. And so then it went to that. And at that time, no one, at least at the state level, really collected donations online, not pledges or even credit cards. So we set up a first project for some state level campaigns in Wisconsin and started running campaign donations and right there online. So that was a huge learning experience because the campaign finance laws were still being followed from like 1974. So there was real no, you know, basis point of any type of reference for digital and how money is now transferred and things of that nature. It was more here, the date of the check or the date of the cash receival. And, you know, so we got into more of a data portion of the company too, so that they can comply to campaign finance law. So it just kind of steamrolled. And so we would eventually set up a kind of a campaign in a box, if you will, where we could flip up a campaign from the media side or the marketing side, from when they announced, where they would have envelopes, letterhead, everything, to a website, to collecting donations. So we were kind of a full scale campaign in a box, if you want to simplify it, everything they needed to get rolling, and then, you know, continue on down the line to when they had to comply and, you know, register their donations and things like that.
Okay. So you mentioned the campaign in a box, and that's the easy contribution, but I'm curious, so maybe before we get into that,
sure.
What were some of those changes that had to be made for the rules for campaign contributions when we started collecting online contributions? And this is something that, you know, this political topic is something that I thought would be interesting to dive into and discuss this sort of stuff as we're coming into an election year here in 2020. But back then in the 90s and early 2000s, what were some of the things that had to be put in place from a regulatory standpoint?
Well, we had to change, or I guess adhere to, because they weren't going to change their, you know, entire rule system. And we consulted with an attorney who was an expert in campaign finance. He actually was a staffer during like some of the federal oversight that happened with, was it McCain-Feingold, I think? Mm-hmm. And so he was not only a nationwide expert, but then resided here at Wisconsin. And didn't matter on either side of the aisle, he was everybody's go-to. So he advised us to say, sometimes as long as you can prove time date stamp. And I said, well, that's data. I mean, that's everything with online. I mean, it's actually more accurate than, because anyone could post data check if they wanted. I said, so if we're actually more accurate. So he said, let's just play mm-hmm. within their rules. And as long as we can say within 15 days, people will be funded, because that's what it was. You had to actually say you made a pledge. So whether it was, you know, in the old days, you know, phone or direct mail, you basically made a pledge to a campaign, and they had to, within 15 days, say that the money became, you know, realized as cash. So we easily could fit that, even in the, I don't want to call it the infancy of online, but, you know, with gateways and credit card processors, you had a lag between when the transaction was made and then when was it deposited into the bank. So that was the biggest worry, was really when does the campaign get funded? And it was more of a campaign finance expert who maybe with a campaign to say, well, I consider it when they made the pledge, other people consider it when the cash is in the bank. And the state clearly says that it was when it was in the bank. Now they've kind of gone a little bit to say, well, you can either as long as you're within that window. So we did do some changes that we can get into later with some of the other software titles we have for packs and things like bundlers, like conduits. However, we'll stick to where we're at right now. So we really didn't change the regulations. We just made sure that our process fell within the boundaries that were already set up. Because sometimes if you stir the pot, you be careful what you ask for, you might get it type of thing. So as long as we could actually go in and prove from a data standpoint and, you know, from our data to basically where the bank received the funds, then we were okay.
Okay. And I'm curious, like, so what were some of the first campaigns you worked on? I mean, can you say the names of people that you worked with back then? I mean, were they state senators, local politicians, or how did you sort of first get started and kind of like with who?
Sure. Well, I mentioned a college roommate of mine actually was working at the Capitol here in Wisconsin. And when my wife and I moved here after she was done with grad school, that's when they said, hey, you know, can you print anything? And so it was state Senate campaigns at the time, or one in particular that we started with the printing. And then I got involved with some of the people who were more or less directing all of the messaging and campaign finance for this state of Wisconsin Senate campaigns. Now, we always had intentions of being like just bipartisan. You know, we wanted to be able to provide a service. We didn't necessarily want to be, they call it, you know, like a shop, which would be, you know, where a Republican shop or a Democrat shop, they would call them, you know, where sometimes like with printers, I mean, because data is everything. They get a little freaked out. You know, they don't want their data or their lists. But we really wanted to be, you know, party agnostic, if you will. And but that didn't happen, only because quickly after we started this whole process, we realized there was a PAC on the Democrat side that basically did all the services at cost or for free and considered it as a PAC, you know, contribution, to where on the Republican side, they were more for, you know, capitalism, if you will. And I don't want to get into the whole, you know, each party, but it just turned out that more Republicans were interested in working with us than Democrats. And it was more of not by anything other than the Democrats already had a thing put in place through this, this PAC. So we are bipartisan, but by nature, Republicans are pretty much the only ones that worked with us on a consistent basis. So, but it started out on the Senate level, state-led Senate level, and we've worked on presidential campaigns all the way down to alderman races in the city of Milwaukee and little towns and things like that. So we've done it all, but it started out on state Senate, and then here in Wisconsin, they call it the House of Representatives. They call it Assembly. So
yeah,
that was kind of our major footprint here in Wisconsin, and how we learned a lot about how the campaign world works and how can we spread out into either other states or federal and things like that. So that's how that started.
Well, it makes sense that, you know, the network you gain of clients, if they're one particular party or another, regardless of what you, I mean, you know, the work you're doing is all would be the same for either party, but it kind of makes sense that both parties wouldn't necessarily work with the same vendors because they'd think, wait a minute, you're helping this guy that he was my opponent in the last, you know, I'm not sure I want to work with you if you're helping him, right?
Exactly. And back then, the privacy laws either didn't exist or they were not known about. So by nature, it wasn't built in that you have to have a standard of ethics, if you call it that, through like privacy and, you know, for the internet as it relates to the internet and online. So it was kind of a little more guerrilla. You know, I don't call it warfare, but campaign fare or whatever. They like you said, they had their guys and the other side had their guys. And I ended up on the one side. So it kind of just by nature of keeping their cards close to their chest, it kind of fell that way.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because, I mean, our clients that we were building custom software solutions for, I mean, obviously, as individuals, they range the gamut in terms of their political beliefs, but it doesn't really impact or touch any of the work we do. So nobody ever really, like, it doesn't come up, you know what I mean?
Right.
But if it did, if we were building, you know, systems specifically for a particular platform, like, yeah, it would tie in, I'm sure. So, it's interesting, but
yeah, I'm sorry. That was a little bit why we wanted to actually Easy Contribution started as a software title. And then we actually made it a company because we did kind of want our other entities because we had growth projections and plans to not be political because, you know, it's just, we wanted to run a business. So we kind of kept that as this is a political based or nonprofit. Was really the intention, a political nonprofit, so that way we could have a little bit of what you had and have to where politics doesn't matter. You know, it's separate because we really didn't want to be labeled as a political based company because we had services and things that we wanted to provide for everybody or as many people as we could affect.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, because I think the two main sort of politically oriented products you have is Easy Contribution, which is a campaign in a box, and then Easy Conduit, right? Those are both, I think, for that industry sort of, is that correct?
Yeah, that's fair. Absolutely. Okay. We did have another title for PAX, but by compliance really dictated how the software was developed. So by nature, PAX report almost identically to campaigns. So we developed a software for what in Wisconsin they call our conduits. In other states they call them bundlers. But basically, if you're a PAC, you know, they wanted a way for businesses or trade associations or organizations to be able to fund campaigns or at least get credit for it. So they set up a thing in Wisconsin called the conduit where they would bundle money together from individuals and deposit it or donate it in group. So if there was five people in a conduit, everyone threw in $100, they would say, here, candidate, here's $500 from the ABC organization, but really it's reported from the five individuals. So it was a very manual process, and there was transmittal letters, it's called, and different things to where it's almost like how you file your taxes. You know, do you do the standard deduction or when you do line items and things like that? So they each line item was a donor. And so we developed an electronic platform that was able to collect the deposits from the conduit members. And then it sits there. And when the organization says, hey, we want to donate to all these different, and those were many, many times, especially for the trade organizations and lobby type things, totally bipartisan because they supported both sides. So that was a great thing for us to get a little bit out of that, I guess, one-sided realm. And it was more about software than just, and data than it was about just collecting as much money as you possible and then reporting at the end. So it was an awesome project because there were so many unique data and reporting needs, and you had to track from as soon as funds were deposited all the way through to where it ended into the campaign coffers. Hmm. So it was one of the coolest and the most exciting projects that we worked on from scratch, because all these big systems like ours nationwide, if they weren't from Wisconsin, which not many were, they didn't understand the bundler thing and all the different intricacies, if you will, or details of how to report. So we were fortunate for that, but it was also, I knew we were developing something that was extremely niche. And so that could be a downfall as well. But I saw some opportunities that since it could be a communication and a data trail, that we could really use it to learn about just all sorts of data and compliances and paper trails. And we were really getting heavy into the payments world at that time as well. So how could it relate to other business cases, whether it be political or otherwise? And so Easy Conduit, I think, fundamentally changed me personally as how I approach technology and payments and data. So for me, for my personal growth as a, I don't want to call myself a developer, but a kind of an architect of software and data and communication, it was a game changer for us and on a lot of levels. So it was great.
So when it comes to PACs, political action committees, and their reporting, you know, one of the aspects of those that is sort of unique and maybe somewhat sometimes controversial is sort of not knowing exactly who plays into it. So I imagine when it comes to, you know, some of the reporting and stuff that you have to do, I mean, do you get demands from folks saying, hey, we need to know who contributed? Or, you know, is that something you have to sort of battle and be involved in? Or is that something they sort of pull out through your tools and sort of like, what are they? I mean, there's compliance with just the legal rules they have to follow, but then there's other things that obviously there's people trying to uncover who's involved with, you know, this stuff. I mean, how does that affect sort of the privacy that you guys have to deal with and the reporting you have to sort of supply?
Right. So you said it best where you said the tools. I mentioned one of our major advisors who's an attorney in the campaign finance world. He right away said, I like when you call it a tool because you don't want to be a campaign finance expert and you don't want to do filings for people. Okay. Let them do that. You know, let them file it. Yeah. You give them the data and the tool to export and import. And then later on became, you know, APIs and things of that nature. But really at the end of the day, we want to provide a tool that they can get customized data to fit the data pockets into their regulatory body, whether it be state, federal, and or whatnot. So for us, yeah, I'm sure people would want us to give the data, but we had a strict policy from day one that, you know, that's all we are is a tool. So if you had an authorized account, you could do what you want with that data. Even in between to where once it was campaigns where they said, hey, campaign A wanted to share their data with campaign B. So it's like, what's good for the whole group? I would say that's fine, but you can do that. So we always stayed with, you know, good fences make good neighbors policy from a data standpoint. And it also gave them a little bit more of the driver's seat. How it's reported, PACs, like you said, people don't know. It's because really PACs typically don't donate to a campaign. They purchase media or other get out the vote or things like that on behalf of. So they might do, you know, negative advertising against a campaign. And then it always says at the bottom, paid for by ABC PAC or, you know, type of thing. To where conduits, that's where the control was. You are able to see a lot much more transparent who the donors were. So that's why they were able to donate to a campaign versus on behalf of them messaging and things of that nature. So that was exciting because from a data perspective, again, we were able to create some really great communication and reporting tools that facilitated that transparency.
And I think you mentioned like the get out the vote stuff. Is that something that Easy Contribution also kind of manages, is basically mining voter data and that sort of stuff as well, and managing the volunteers or is there, because I think you do some stuff in that space too, right?
Sure. Voter data, the campaigns always got themselves. So, but they could pump in data into our system. And that's kind of where that campaign in a box kind of comes back full circle, is whether they had data that came in through our system through donors, or it was when we would build them maybe a campaign site that would tie into Easy Contribution and whatnot. So you have your volunteers, right? Then you have your donors, and you kind of have all these buckets of people and you try to get the most out of every one of them. So that's then where we kind of took a fundraising tool to make it more of a marketing, get out the vote. So help them manage their data. Cause, you know, basically at the end of the day, you know, everyone gets, I always call it data drunk. You know, you just don't know what to do with it all. And we were trying to say, you have so much data, you're not using it enough or you're not using it properly. And so we help them utilize our existing tools and sometimes other CRMs and other types of tools that we would consult them on to get the most out of their data that they possibly could. So did we, and then obviously, hey, we can do personalized printing. So then we went, boom, full scale back into the MSA world of doing general marketing, you know, the software for digital variable print. So trying to say whether they wanted to just collect funds and then go on down the line where we can impact their organization from start to finish and many places in between was the goal. How many touch points can we have with the client?
And you talk about digital variable printing. And so something I've seen a lot here, or you hear a lot of talk about in Cincinnati here, is what Kroger has done with Dunnhumby and 8451 with their membership and loyalty cards and all that sort of personalized coupons and stuff that come in the mail. And it sounds like with the printing that you're doing some of that same stuff with their data and customizing a bit what they receive in terms of political mailers and stuff. It seems like there could be some kind of crossover of approaches there.
Oh, absolutely. We got involved in a larger statewide gubernatorial campaign. And that's kind of at that time, probably 2008 or so, was when these loyalty programs were really starting to get hot, you know? So it's kind of funny you say, all right, what, because we started talking to these campaigns and say, they're like, are you an expert in campaigns or political? And I said, well, you know, our strength is business and data and messaging and marketing. So all these experts sat at the table for this gubernatorial campaign and they were all political. And I was kind of like the one, I mean, yeah, we had political experience, but like I said, we really wanted to be, you know, a software company and a solutions company. Didn't want to totally be defined by just politics because we did have other, you know, arms, if you will, or verticals that we were doing on a general business in MSA and otherwise. So I said, if they treat campaigns like a business and all their issues, meaning their issues, not challenges. I mean, when a campaign has issues, you know, whether it be taxes, whether it be, you know, all the different things that they run on, they want, some people are concerned about taxes and education and other are for, you know, gun rights or not and things. So everyone, you have all these buckets of people. And I said, your goal is to, if you have a universe, they call it a universe, which is your list, your master list of people. Excuse me. If you have 100,000 people and that's divided up into these four or five buckets of, let's just say four buckets of issues or things you're running on, you might have, you know, 10,000 in this bucket, 30,000 in that. And so on, all the way up to the 100,000. I said, your goal is that everyone in your universe cares about all your issues as much as possible. So the end goal is if you had 100,000 list, that you would end up with really 400,000, meaning everyone cares about education. Everyone cares about this, this, and this. And that way you have more of an impact on that individual person. And if people then will get engaged, they'll volunteer. And if they'll volunteer, they may donate. And if they do either one of those, they're going to vote. So it was really that kind of conversion. We'll call it like a sales conversion, if you will, but convert them. Like everything's a transaction and it doesn't necessarily have to be monetary. It's how do we get them to take action in particular on put a yard sign, go knock doors, hand out literature, you know, the volunteer stuff, all the way down to forwarding an email. Say, hey, forward to your friend if it's a, you know, get out the vote, or if it's a donation-based, you know, plea. Get people engaged, get them going. You know, this is before the whole grassroots thing became kind of known to everybody. You know, let's be honest, the Obama campaign changed the way campaigns are run. They were very effective in get out the vote, get organized, things like that. So we tried in some levels to have data do that. And now we hear all the time. I'm not saying we're the front runners of it, but seeing that data was important from us from a company fundamental because of that digital variable print aspect. That's kind of how I pushed our advice, if you will, of how to use different political tools that we would either build or sometimes customize for the campaigns and whatnot.
Okay. And you mentioned sort of, you know, what you all have been on the vanguard of, or and it sounds like you've done a lot of innovative things. And I think even just, you know, you mentioned you were one of the first folks out there trying to get groups to accept electronic payments. You know, is that sort of what you see as one of the most innovative things you've done in your time, or where have you really driven innovation outside of that?
Yeah, I would think in the political space, you know, definitely that was a big one for us to, you know, overcome the fees and, you know, kind of the burden the hand is worth, you know, two in the bush. But I would say for innovation, it was how to use existing data to impact the greater, you know, influence that they had on the campaign from an individual standpoint. So I would say, yeah, payments. And then we also did have an advisory opinion done to change political compliance. As I said earlier, we didn't want to, but there was one where from the organizations like Conduits, they had to physically write a check to the campaigns. And on a large campaign, mm-hmm. they would have just way too many checks to process. So we were the first, at least in our state, to be able to, on a technology side, and also we got the advisory opinion, which is kind of a change in the law, to say that you can now send funds from one organization to a campaign electronically, whether it be e-check, ACH type, or credit card and what have you. So it sped up the time it took for funding, and it also from a really workforce to just get checks calculated, deposited, things of that nature, done. And I would say from an innovation standpoint, it's still actually not super common. And I think that's a huge asset for us and why we probably get more of the organizational political action committees, but the conduits and you don't want to call it special interest, but any trade association, they're all politically active. And for them to be able to not have to deal with kind of the old school checks and things like that, that gives us a huge competitive advantage mixed with the data trail.
Yeah. And so especially when you look at recently, there's been so many big changes in just the payment industry in general. Obviously you go from checks to credit cards to things like PayPal, that's sort of been long established. But then more recently you've got Bitcoin, you've got other blockchain driven payment systems like Veeam, you've mm-hmm. got, you know, stuff like Venmo that's out there. Is that something that political campaigns are able to, or you think they will be able to? I've not seen any that are able to accept Venmo, for instance. Do you think that is something that will be seen soon in that arena? And are you getting a lot of pressure or questions about that? Or where do you think that'll go?
We haven't had any questions on it that I know of. However, I think as processing fees are lower and, you know, it's all a matter then of having probably where it will be, where we do both data and processing. When I say processing, I mean payments processing through, you know, other gateways, credit card processors. We work with them to where we kind of tried to be the one solution. Now APIs are all over the place. It really should be a lot easier for people to pick and choose how money is transferred and received, and then their data. The problem is the other companies like ours, they want a piece of the processing, and the Venmos and things like that are really more focused on how low can we get the fees for the transfer. And that's all they're focused on. So they really collect not enough data. So it would have to be kind of like, you know, the Reese's Pieces, you know, chocolate and peanut butter. They would have to choose to work together. And at this point, it just would probably be, you know, a distraction to the Venmos and things like that. PayPal has been a pretty big force in the political world, just because, like you said, it's been around for a long time. And when you asked about our innovation, some of our most innovative stuff was always also kind of an Achilles heel because we might have been too early to the game and it wasn't, you know, if it's not practiced, sometimes they say it's better to be the better mousetrap than, you know, the first one to it. So I think sometimes mm-hmm. the greatest innovation could also be a little bit of a downfall. And we've definitely had our share of that and for sure, but that doesn't take away from what we've learned from it and that, but from a marketing standpoint or a bring to market standpoint wasn't always the best.
Yeah. Cause it's interesting. I've helped a little bit with some nonprofits here in the area when it comes to fundraising and doing just some like fundraising campaigns. And, you know, I think there's the lower the barrier, sort of barriers to entry and the easier, you know, the higher ease of use that you can allow people to have when it comes to something like donating money, right? Mm-hmm. Or especially setting up recurring campaigns, people are getting so used to that. And there's also like a reward sort of serotonin type thing in your brain, like when you know, hold your thumbprint down on your phone and it's just cha-ching, you know, that I expect that there will be some better solutions there in the future, as opposed to sort of like more old school, like go and fill out the web form for your PayPal credit card thing or something, right? You know, because if you can send someone a text, for instance, and they click it and it opens in Venmo and you just hit approve a $15 a month recurring subscription, for instance. And right now you can't really do that with Venmo because it's only person to person and it's not person to organization,
right?
And I guess to some degree you could do that with PayPal, with PayPal's app. But I've just found that, you know, sort of allowing people to do it really quickly, they're more likely to do it at all, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because they don't want to have to enter too much data, you know?
Well, and that's the thing. That's the little bit of the difference between political and nonprofit is I think compliance requirements have inhibited, I guess, progress in that kind of, like you said, thumbprint or quick, easy, or get a text. I know, like I mentioned, the Obama campaign, they had where they would sign people up and get all of their campaign finance requirements out of the way. So they kind of signed up people as this organization, if you will, or grassroots. And so they would already have all the information they needed. So then they could send out the text to say, boom, click here and approve $20. And then it just went. So they didn't have to comply on the spot every single time because they almost had like an account, kind of like Amazon, you know, one-click purchase. So that's kind of a big ticket item for bigger campaigns, but it's just still not practical from a technology cost standpoint for smaller. But I think for sure on the nonprofit level where you have less requirements, where it's more on the donor side to say, hey, I gave to this organization and it's tax deductible, yada, yada, yada. That's the requirements for who gave are a lot less and how much they gave. That's the other thing with political. You can only give so much to a particular campaign. And a level of campaign. So,
yeah, because you figure, I mean, I think right now, if you, at least any political contributions I've made, of course, it asks, are you a US citizen? Usually, I think it asks, who do you work for, if I'm not mistaken? Of course, it asks your address and such. And so, part of the problem is if it was as easy as just, you know, go to the such and such campaign app and tap with your finger and boom. Well, they don't, like, do they know that you're a U.S. citizen? Do they know, they don't know anything about you, right? What if you work for, I don't know, the federal government or somebody who's, I mean, I think there's certain jobs you might have where you're not allowed to contribute or something, right?
Right.
And how would they're not going to be able to easily find that through a Venmo transaction or even, you know, or anything like the whole, like, iMessage, send money to people type functionality that Apple has built out. It doesn't have enough information. So to your point, if they had it all set up and entered ahead of time, they knew like, oh, this cell phone number right here, that's for Sam. And yes, he's a US citizen. And we know that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but that's a whole lot of data set up to get it in ahead of time.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's that groundwork that has to be done. And so only the larger campaigns with really good organization, outreach and things like that can really accomplish that. And, you know, you mentioned the employer and the job and this and that, and there's all these different data points that change that. And it's usually, all right, at least here in our state, it's, have you, is, is the donation over $200? Well, then you have to answer more things about employment. Then it's also, well, is it $200 per donation or is it in total? So if I have given $50 four times, then now I hit that $200 threshold. So there's still a lot of requirements on the donor side and the campaign side because, you know, it's illegal for me or you or anyone to give over the limit to a particular campaign or a candidate. So you have to be aware of how much you're giving. And a lot of times they compile it by household. So then if you have, you know, a husband, wife, partners, what have you, who are both politically active, you kind of have to, the left hand knows what the right hand's doing. So it's still more about data than just about anything. And that's why we said, if we get people focusing on the data part, it can affect their entire organization from getting, you know, volunteers and all the things we spoke about earlier. So to keep them engaged and easily managing their data, that was always our goal. However, you mentioned apps. So we made a fundamental choice to, we said, all right, we're either going to have to change our entire platform or we're going to go really even more specific to build customized things for particular organizations. And so now with campaigns, there's so many apps out there that are available and they keep things, like you said, a little bit more simple, click, click, and they want to almost get out of, they'll say, here's the data over here, here's the funding over here. And now it's on the campaign again to match them up. So there's been a little bit of a void and we kind of avoided it ourselves to do more of those specialized applications to make it more of a business type thing than it was strictly donations or strictly data. And so that's how we got more into the political organization fundraising now versus campaigns. Do we work with campaigns? Absolutely. But it's not our primary focus anymore because it's getting with social media and all these other things. It was by the time you're done developing an app, it's already out of date and it took a lot of focus of energies and people. So we made a kind of an effort to be great at a few things versus good at many, many things. And so from our standpoint, it's more quality than quantity anymore from how we impact a particular customer or group of. So,
well, and it seems like all the compliance stuff, just because, you know, a lot of that is based on sort of the old way of doing things, or at least if there's campaigns that aren't really with it from a data perspective, let's say, or small campaigns and such, you know, it's so easy. It'd be so easy for a taxpayer or for anybody who wants to contribute to sort of skirt the rules, because it's not like it's, you know, they can look at the checks that were sent from a certain person and that's the only way they get campaigns or contributions rather. I mean, if I had 10 credit cards and I just used a bunch of different addresses and my mom's address or whatever, it'd be really difficult to figure out that I was $1 over the limit, right? So absolutely. It seems to me like they're probably, it's really got to be really hard for them to be responsible for that compliance and to even really know when there's minor violations. And major violations, you know, obviously would stand out like a sore thumb, right?
Absolutely.
Somebody gives 10 times what they're allowed, but little people giving $50 too much here or there, I mean, geez, how do you ever catch that?
It's really challenging and it's scary because, you know, it's always retroactive. You know, you don't know, you know, everyone talks about the tax laws that are so complicated. It's the same level of complexities from the campaign finance area. So people would ask us all the time, we really want to protect our members. This is coming from like trade associations and things like that, or companies that are politically active so that they don't go over their limit. I said, well, from your organization standpoint, you know, we're not giving advice, but I would stay very clear saying you have to put the onus on the donor, unfortunately, because if they donated through your organization or even just taken one campaign, I donate online and my wife donates with a check, or even myself, I go to an event and you think, oh, this is for an event. I'm paying for my, you know, maybe my meal and my, you know, what have you. Well, you don't think of that as a donation, but it is. It's a donation. So I wrote a check for $100 to go to an event in particular, and then I may, a few months later, donate another amount of money online. I'm not connecting those, you know, potentially, and I don't think the donors do, and that's where people get themselves caught. So there's a lot of sending money back to people, I think, and stuff like that. So everybody has to be on the same page, and it's like you said, extremely challenging.
Well, and you mentioned the meals and such, and I know there's I think when you watch some of these political dramas, I saw somewhere that, you know, if you go to an event, a lot of times, at least this is what this one particular fictional show is saying, is that if there's no chairs or anything at the event, if you're walking and standing and eating snacks, whatever, well, that's not a meal, right? But if you're sitting down at a table, that's a meal, and you have to report that. Someone's giving you a free meal or you know what I mean, donated a meal to you or whatever type stuff. So it's funny, it seems like there must be some little wrinkles in those rules, right?
Oh, for sure. And like I said, we don't get into that at all, just because, you know, we wanted to stay away from being on the hook for giving, you know, I always say no advice is better than bad advice.
Exactly.
So we want to be ones and zeros, you know, just all data.
Yeah.
But you're right.
So what do you think coming into 2020 here, and we've discussed this a little bit before, but, you know, what are some of the major innovations around data and sort of campaign drives and all the, and voter sort of information management? If you look at those, all those little categories, what are some of the things that we'll see new in this election that we didn't see in 2016's election, presidential election?
Well, I think if anyone's paying attention to the news now, they're already talking about polls. And because, you know, in the last time they had Hillary Clinton winning big, you know, the whole thing. I won't go through, you know, the whole thing, but I think everyone's afraid of why was it so wrong? And was it, you know, now this is not our business. We got involved in some things because everyone wanted the data to share and you know, because donors this and this, but so they would compile all the data now through these massive systems. And so I think everyone learned a lot from that last campaign. But I'm not sure, in my opinion, this is now just being not the guy who does political and data type information for campaigns and political. Me as a, I don't want to call it a citizen, but just a bystander, I'm not so sure the big data companies or anyone, they learned a lot, but I'm not sure they're putting it to action or know how to. So I think a lot of people are shooting from the hip. And, you know, people were also wondering, you know, from an organizational standpoint, who's really running the data? Since, you know, President Trump, it looked like, you know, he self-funded a lot of it last time, to where now they're doing a lot of fundraising. So I think their data is going to be just as new and not stale. Typically, we have an incumbent. A lot of time, their data is stale because they don't start as much of the activity as early as when there's, you know, 10 candidates in a primary, you know, so the machine, if you will, starts percolating and going earlier with those types. But right now they're picking up the game. So everything's starting earlier. And so I think as they're accumulating data, they know now that they need to segment it and treat the data with care. But I'm not so sure they know how to take that third party data and really filter it through. In my opinion, it'd be really challenging because we're finding that even data companies, social media has been accused of kind of curbing, you know, whether they are on the right or left. So I think the data segment is going to get smaller and everyone's going to maybe just bypass all that social media and other things as fluff. And that might prove to be the successful way to go, or a huge, huge mistake. You know, so I just think that they eventually said, hey, we have to make a choice and can't do analysis to paralysis. So for me, I think everyone's kind of figuring it out right now. And I think if they say we're going to just keep the doors closed and just use our data. So I think internal polling is going to get a lot stronger versus, you know, I think you've mentioned some of our either previous conversations, you know, different polling companies or data companies that got paid a lot of money and they were way wrong, you know? So I think it'll be interesting.
Well, and I think from the, we've talked a little bit about the impact of bots and AI in the space, particularly just around, if you think of the, you know, gathering or sort of, you know, campaigning for contributions, managing contributions, and getting out to vote and sort of activities like that. I could see certainly more of those people interacting more with those type of AI bots on websites and whatnot to, and via text, for instance, to make those sort of things less resource intensive.
Absolutely. Well, I went, earlier in our conversation today, I talked about how I went into a meeting and said, well, here's what I would do. Treat it like a business. You have all these different issues. We got to treat those like verticals. That was all manual, you know, because most of their lists were old and, you know, so there was no real way to say who's active and who's not. The AI, I mean, that we were, you know, trying to do that 15 years ago, but manual. And it's so laborious. And that AI component will just impact this and has in a huge way. That way they can throw just tons of data at it and get not only a quicker result, but a more accurate, and it will only get more accurate, you know, just by the nature of the AI, you know, platform or, you know, what have you. So you're absolutely right. I mean, just besides the labor intensiveness of it, just the accuracy and how much data you can actually process more accurately is the key. And it's, man, kind of like wish I had this then, or wish I knew then what I know now type of thing. It would totally change the way we did our business. And we might be more focused in that now versus kind of saying, well, we had to choose. There was a fork in the road and we either go all in again. It was almost going to be like starting a whole nother organization or company. And we chose not to. We started to be more on data and payments versus being a all encompassing political facilitator. And we chose not to do that. And I'm kind of glad, just because still to this day, it's as we found out, you mentioned from the last campaign cycle and now moving into this one, it's almost more of a guessing game because there's so much data. You know, again, how do what do you trust? Your own systems, their systems, meaning the third party, the media, all these others. So polls are scary.
You'd have to have a whole team of data scientists too anymore. I mean, you'd be a data science company to really make a big splash in that space, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm curious on the payment side, and when you're sort of bringing a new customer in, I imagine that's very cyclical because, you know, you're not going to have a new customer coming on in October right before an election, right? So is that something, is there a huge amount of ebb and flow to that? You know, do you get a ton of requests 18 months before an election and then, you know, minimal sort of interest for 2 years after that? Or how does it sort of onboard with customers, and what's that cycle look like, kind of?
Yeah, exactly like you said. When you said 18 months, it is like that more now. In the past, when we first got into it, they're like, oh, don't worry about it. You know, we don't really start cooking until 6 months before or whatever. We kind of said, hey, you know, people are starting to fundraise pretty much nonstop now. And we were promoting that, obviously, because it was our business model and it's how we made revenue and things like that. But it's gotten, I don't want to call it crazy, but there is an ebb and flow. There's the high times, cyclical, seasonal, if you want to call it. But people are managing donations pretty much year round now. Now it does it spike and plateau and then go down? Absolutely. And then like the onboarding, you know, we just had a few recently, you know, like I said, very small campaigns, some bigger. But They're definitely starting earlier and continuing the process much longer even afterwards, if they win, especially, or if they're planning their next one. So there's definitely peaks and valleys, but there's much more of a less of a sharp spike because people realize, one, it's easier to set up the systems. You know, we have it down. Our, you know, KYC process with Know Your Customer or Know Your Campaign, I like to say, for us. We also do, you know, payments for other industries, but that whole process we have down almost like a profile with the different processors and partners that we have in that realm. So we can flip a campaign on really quickly, you know, where it was weeks in the beginning. Now it's hours or days, really, where we can get things set up. We know exactly the profile. But yeah, definitely now, I mean, especially since this 2020 thing, everyone's starting again. You know, even the smallest campaign on a, maybe a state or local level, it's when people are in the mood, even though people say they hate it, they're still motivated and they're active and they're thinking about it. So when the juices are flowing, people jump on. So it's that activity level is spread out more, but there's definitely spikes, absolutely, for us.
And talk a little bit about that setup process. I mean, what is that onboarding and setup process? What does that involve, or what do you have to do there?
Yeah, now we, like I said, we have it down. It's all online, and we send out, if someone is interested, they, you know, come on our website, send an email through our boarding system, and then we'll immediately send them out. Here's what you need, because people don't know sometimes. And even the old, some campaigns have been around a long time, you know, they're, hey, what's your EIN number? I don't even have one. Well, now all new campaigns do. So we kind of have that KYC process that we say, here's what you need. You know, it's basically the same thing you need if you're going to set up a bank account. So we send them this pre-app checklist. That way, once they do go online, because now it's so easy to apply, that they're not prepared with the information and then they start and stop. So we don't want them to start and stop because they may not come back. And if they don't come back, then their consultants are mad because they're not able. They sent out a mailer and they can't take contributions, and it's a total nightmare for them. And so we try to make the process as easy and organized for them as possible. So we just give them, you know, a little, all the pieces for the birdhouse, and they can just quickly build it, you know, part A, B, C. So right on down the line, they apply online, and then it gets sent to an onboard, then it gets to underwriting, then it gets to where we build and flip up their system. And if they have a website, do we have to integrate it? You know, so it just goes on down the line, kind of, you know, like the Henry Ford you know, type deal, where every part of the car eventually gets put together. And it happens so quickly now. Like I said, I think our pre-boarding is much more important than the actual application process now. So that way they're feeling less overwhelmed, and things used to be, how quickly can you do it? Now it's so quick that we want to make sure they have all the right things to put into the system, so that way it doesn't get hung up.
Gotcha. I'm curious what some of the more rewarding projects you've worked on in this space have been. I know there's been some projects you've worked on that were small sort of local efforts that grew and sort of exploded and became more national stage. And talk a little bit about those projects and sort of how you were involved and what, how those were rewarding for you professionally.
For me professionally, I mean, that's a key factor, but it's all about what we learned. And it affected our entire company from political on, from a technology infrastructure standpoint. We had been part of a campaign, small, moving on up, and then it was a statewide. And basically, I was entrenched into the campaign and to learn as much as possible about it, because most of the apps and things like that now have all been started by people who were politicals. And, you know, we were a company that never had intention of becoming a political based or political service engine. And it was by accident. So we kind of fell into it. And as one particular project grew and grew, we were there from the beginning. And like I said earlier with the AI question, where we were trying to manually do AI with data and how to get old data and people active again and see what data was junk and what not. And then we mixed that in with our donation process. And we got to a point where, yes, there was a campaign, and not just a campaign, but an entire system, political system, campaign system that was extremely volatile, and it went nationwide. And to the fact that they were, you know, people would be on Fox News or CNN and different MSNBC. And every time we had to work very closely with the political organizations and of that time to say, all right, you got to tell us when you're going to be on the media, because every time they were a huge spike in donations or volunteers and things like that. And so we were just moving to the cloud actually at that time. And we configured with a technology partner of ours, group of engineers, to configure different firewall settings and basically, you know, not to be technical, but to almost opposite of that, but daisy chain, you know, flip up cloud servers for resources. So that way we wouldn't crash, because if we did, there would be no data. There would be maybe partial data collected, donations not processed. So from pushing the throttle standpoint of what the technology can do and how do we put together a platform that can expand and contract at will was extremely rewarding. We were able to figure out at a major, you know, host, if you want to call it that, you know, Amazon, Rackspace type server farms, to configure, to make a configuration so that we could utilize the cloud in an e-commerce situation and still be PCI compliant. And we were just doing what was necessary. And you know, months later, we found out, hey, we're now using that whole platform you guys built with our systems. And I wish I would have been able to coin it or something like that, because I could have then sold it to, you know, the powers that be, meaning, you know, the technology providers. But for us to be able to figure out quickly how to expand and contract with kind of a national message, regardless of it being political, it really gave us a huge insight on how being nimble and able to pivot quickly, but yet still provide a platform that was, you know, really gold standard, rock solid from a data perspective, was not just rewarding, but, you know, really, really important from the growth of our organization in total, and how we then take it and would then go and consult with other companies to actually kind of give that story and give that inclination of, you know, definitely in some spaces, you don't want to be the super tanker, you know, with, it's hard to turn that super tanker around in the ocean, but, you know, the jet ski, if you will, can do circles, and you had to be in between. So being kind of that mid-size, nimble, able to react, taught us a ton about how we would develop systems, how we would interact with other systems, how we choose our partners, if you will. It gave us so much insight on who we want to be and who we want to be with. I can't say how much I learned on that particular. So it was gratifying to be there at ground level from their organization and see growth and see, you know, the ups and downs of some of this political angst. But more importantly was how it changed, at least in our local landscape here in Wisconsin and things like that, how much stronger they are now with or without us. I mean, they've moved on, obviously, in many aspects because there's different products. And we chose, like I said earlier, not to continue on some paths and be great at a few things versus good at many things. We were, I feel, you know, made a really good contribution to them from a kind of a consulting standpoint, as we all learned together. And it's just fun to see that they're still utilizing things that stemmed from challenges that we help them overcome. And so it helped us grow. It helped them grow.
And it seems like, you know, having the infrastructure and sort of dynamically scaling infrastructure in place so that, because it's so easy for politicians or political candidates to sort of go viral nowadays, you know, they, if they're a completely unknown candidate, I mean, you look at Pete Buttigieg in his campaigns right now, pretty much came out of nowhere. And obviously, if he goes and does whatever some of his very first initial interviews were, I mean, I'm sure his website exploded. And that's, it's certainly not uncommon for those sites to go down when that happens, right? And it's not enough for those campaigns to have like a GoDaddy site somewhere, right? That just can't handle the traffic. So, because at any moment, you could have a great speech, do really well, whatever, get an opportunity. And you know, again, if that's when donations are going to flow in, traffic and signups and volunteers are all going to happen, you know, you can't have it, you know, be crashing. And at the same time, and that's sort of what some of the cloud stuff provides, is that ability to scale that you would never have gotten with physical hardware, right?
No way. No way. Not like to be able to turn on a dime, if you will, you know, no pun intended on the campaign finance and political contribution. But yeah, I mean, there was no way to do that. I mean, there were, but it was just financially wasn't possible, you know, even at large campaigns. When you don't have a constant infrastructure, because you mentioned those ups and downs of when it's seasonal and when it's not, if you don't have an infrastructure that's all the time maintained, you have to start and stop. And it's hard to keep that high quality because a campaign ends, right? And so they would just start and stop. And, you know, these mm-hmm. campaign offices, and then they would go away, and they're just a bunch of desks and leftover phones. And, it, you know, it's now everyone has adopted that viral atmosphere, whether you go viral or not. By nature, campaigns kind of have that lifespan, that viral lifespan of, all right, we're on and now we're done. You know, the election's over. So even though once you're elected as an incumbent, you kind of try to keep things going. But I think that word viral is kind of the key word. You know, you never know what's going to happen. Even on a small scale. So like you said, yeah, from a technology infrastructure, you can't just have a little website. And we worry about that now because we went from creating a system to where, when I said we kind of changed how we're doing things for campaigns in particular, is we're now more of app-based, you know, gateway-based, where they can install our contribution system with the campaign finance requirements right on everyday websites. So we run into that to say, you can put it anywhere, but if you do get a spike, unless you're on our, we'll call it, you know, approved hosting platform, we can't guarantee what you're going to do or not. And it doesn't take much, like you said, with kind of those everyday bargain or discount hosting platforms, whether it be GoDaddy or any of the others. Do they have the capacity to do it? Sure, but everyone sees, you know, $1 a year or whatever from all these different people. And it's just not the way. So I think what we learned from that particular, I don't call it campaign, but situation and a couple of years of really dealing with high volume media, influence, social media just grew like crazy at that point. So I think from a business standpoint and utilizing technology, we learned a lot, and it's enabled us to actually help many different organizations, you know, deal with traffic. And it's not always the problem of getting it. It's what do you do with it when it comes? So how do you be prepared and not waste money, time, efforts? Because not everybody can afford a high-end, we'll just call it IT infrastructure, you know? And so kind of like campaign in a box. Now it could be, you know, infrastructure in a box, if you will. We're able to say what you need and what you don't need. And relatively speaking, with a little cushion on either side.
Well, and it's interesting because I don't think there's too many organizations out there in the business, in any kind of business world, where, you know, if you look at a major campaign that has thousands of employees, right? And it fires up, it operates for maybe 2 years, and then it basically shuts down and goes to sleep. And then 2 years later, like if you're, say, like the Trump campaign, I mean, obviously they've been continuing to operate for his entire presidency, but they did not have, I wouldn't believe they had all the employees working full time, and they weren't spending, like, let's say in, you know, 12 months after he was elected, they weren't spending anywhere near the same amount of effort, money, data, everything else as they were 5 months before the election, right? And so it's like this constant ebb and flow, and somebody coming back and dusting the spiderwebs off the data and the everything, right? Like you said, telephones, desks, servers, everything. I mean, it would be almost impossible for a lot of businesses to do, because you'd come back and be like, oh man, what version of Windows is this system running? And I mean, just little things like that probably cause a lot of chaos.
There's so much, you know, like you said, every version, you know, I mean, people are bringing their own laptops and, you know, and things like that. And then when they win, half the campaign gets hired. Just, it is what it is. You know, they all talk bad about it, but that's kind of the way it is. If you win, you know, and you're the campaign manager, you're probably going to be chief of staff or what have you. You know, that's not our area, but we've seen enough of the trends to where it's, you win. Sure. And then, your ground game, it gets eaten by what becomes now government employees, because you go from being a campaign to all these people that you know and trust. And And so by nature, you're drying up your talent on the campaign side that still, like you said, it's not just the presidential, every campaign now, they really need to run data and operations all the time. They just have skeleton crews. And how do you do that? You know, utilize technology. Mm-hmm. So one person can do four, you know, work of four people, at least for a little while until they then transition back. And it's, I think a lot of, like I said earlier, we coached the campaigns to think like businesses. I think businesses, you know, I'm just kind of off the cuff right now thinking, can learn a lot about that transition and nimbleness, if you will, that campaigns have to do, because you have to take an entire infrastructure and it gets, like you said, fundamentally destroyed, if you will, or transformed into something else rapidly. And you still have bills to pay and things like that. So I think definitely business can learn a lot from how to do much more with very little.
Well, it probably is similar to like what happens during an acquisition. You know, a business is bought by another business and a new guy comes in and says, what is all this? And if you're a new, really, regardless of if you win or lose an election, because if you lose, you might run again next time. I mean, look at like Hillary, for instance. You know, she, I know, ran multiple times, of course, through the last so many decades, or at least, you know, began exploratory efforts towards that. So, you know, if you're the new campaign manager and you come in and say, well, let me see your, I don't know, send me your Excel sheets you used last time. It's like, what is this? I mean, it's a lot of the same problems, I suppose, if an acquisition happens in the business world and now there's a new IT manager, let's say, or a new CEO or whatever, coming in and figuring out what was done before and you know what I mean? Even just who works here exactly?
Right. Well, there's overlap stuff and like waste, that, right? Know? And in a business yeah. world, they can kind of smooth it out over time, but probably, like you yeah. said, if you look under in between the sheets of the binder, you know, you're finding a lot of duplicate or what is this? How has it been? And government's even worse, you know,
yeah.
what's going on? Because there's always something exactly. new, you know, and there's legacy problems. And so, yeah, I think that from us to be able to step back and be afforded those opportunities of the peaks and valleys of those cycles has actually been, you know, a lot of people say, oh, how do you do it with a business where you're busy, 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 you've got great revenues, and then that the water faucet gets turned off and they have no more need for you and things, you know. So that's how another reason we became diversified for business, to say we need to say, all right, this is a vertical of ours. We work for or provide services for campaigns or political world, but we also, you know, we work with, you know, medical, dental, you know, legal firms, you know, all different business types, engineering, you know, what have you, because we have to be able to not be destroyed. You know, it's kind of like that sales adage. If you have three big customers and you mm-hmm. lose one, that's a third of your revenue gone. So we've learned from that campaign cycle to really manage our businesses much better as well, to say, and to stay away from stealing from Peter to pay Paul. That's been a big thing as well. Well, all right, well, this is making a lot of money now. Let's push it into here. You want to have clear budgets, clear spending patterns and things like that. It's a challenge. Are we great at it? No. Are we better at it than we were? Absolutely. So we've been afforded those peaks and valleys, and I feel like we've learned to utilize the uptime and downtime well. And that's always a challenge with a lot of different startup companies. And that's how I become really a sucker for startups, you know, consulting or helping people start them up or doing our own. I enjoy it so much. And each time, try to do it better. You know, what did we learn from last time? And I think really the political world helped me out as an individual, build teams quickly and be able to make. Do I make the best decisions all the time? No, but I've learned that to make fast decisions, not reckless, but fast decisions are much more effective than, you know, really well-calculated, mitigate all risk. Well, that has posed more problems for us than, like I mentioned, the nimble decision-making, the, you know, quick reaction time. And how do we be proactive instead of reactive? You know, you can't all the time, but I've learned a lot, and I try to pass it on the best I can to who we consult with and or organizations that hire us or that we, you know, help co-found and what have you.
Yeah, well, hopefully there's folks listening to the podcast here that can take something from some of the experiences. And without a doubt, it's pretty impressive, the sort of broad family and portfolio of companies you've been involved with and built and other startups. And so I certainly appreciate you coming on and talking to us and telling us a little bit about your history and background in this. And I think it's all very applicable to what we're going to see coming up here in this next election year. And campaigns and stuff can learn a lot from some of your experience, without a doubt. So if people want to read more about what you're doing and your companies, your main website is oscompanies.com, which has links to all Easy Contribution, Easy Conduit, as well as MSA and some other companies that you work with. So people can go and check out that website if they're looking for more information. And we really appreciate you coming on and talk to us, Mike, and we hope that we can talk again sometime soon.
Hey, appreciate it, Sam. It's been fun. And like I said, you know, like you said, there's a broad range. And my biggest, I guess, comeback to that is always everyone asks, what do you do again? You know, so it's been exciting for us and rewarding. But like I said, when we can take all these different experiences and make a focused effort better each time and just meeting folks like yourself. So appreciate the time. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Unstoppable Talk. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, be sure to support the show by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And learn more about this show by heading over to unstoppablesoftware.com. Until next time, keep innovating.